Thank you. You know, you're supposed to be 50 miles away from home, I think, when you become an expert, and I'm not that far, about 35 miles. So. Dr. Gray had asked a long time ago that Scott Dykes and I come and sort of tag team this lecture or talk today. And Scott had an opportunity to go to a training workshop down in Middle Tennessee. It sort of came up at the last minute through our I&E division, and so he jumped at that chance. But he's contributed a lot to this presentation, as you'll see when we get in the slides. I wanted to give you a pretest because you folks probably know more about amphibians already than 99.99% of the Tennesseans here. So I'd like for you all to go ahead and take this test. And I guess it'll be part of your daily grade here. You can talk amongst yourselves if you want. But I'm going to quickly go through this. So you'll have to either write these questions down or write your answers down, because I'm going to go through these rather quickly and go ahead and get into the main presentation. But I'll go through them all so you'll understand the question. And none of them are trick questions. But the first one just is, how many frogs and toads are native to Tennessee? And that's a number somewhere between 1 and 1,000. So you write whatever you think is appropriate there. And a lot of you had the TAMP workshop already, so you should know that one. Approximately how many salamanders are native to Tennessee? Now, they keep changing the number, and you'll see, I'll get into that more in a moment. And then number 3 is, all Tennessee amphibians lay eggs in water, true or false? It's very simple that you have 50% chance of getting it right. And then the other one is, Tennessee's smallest native salamander by weight, and I will accept 3 species. Because there's very, very little difference in 3 of the species that we have. But at least you know that, as far as the salamanders, you know there's at least 3. So see, I'm kind of helping you a little bit. Let's see, where do I point this? Do we get it? No, to get it to go forward.
Go ahead and hit down.
Down. Oh. Okay. All right, Tennessee's largest native salamander by weight, not by length, is... And then what is Tennessee's official state amphibian? What is the official state amphibian? I got to go lobby. It's the only time I've lobbied, but had positive results. 7 is, what is the daily bag limit for Tennessee's only game amphibian? The daily bag limit. Not possession limit, but bag limit. You're not writing these down. Oh. What Tennessee salamander is known from only 2 specimens? 2 specimens. What salamander is only known from 2 specimens? That's number 8. Number 9 is, what Tennessee frog is known from only 2 specimens from 1 county? Now that's a little bit misleading, because the salamander is also from 1 county. So I didn't want to trick you into thinking that the range in Tennessee is more than 1 county, but it's only 1 county for both the frog and the salamander. Number 10, the Yonalossi salamander is found in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. True or false? Number 11, Weller's salamander is found in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. True or false? And then number 12, you should get this one too. You got the first one and the last one, so give me. Name the author or authors. You can be real generous here, of a book that contains information about amphibians in Tennessee. So that's 12 questions, and you can pick 10 of those just to make it even. Just pick 10, and then they'll be worth 10 points apiece. If you pick all 12, you'll get 2 bonus questions. And I'll try to answer this as we go through the presentation here. Okay, I'm going to get this off the screen so you won't see this ever again. Let's see, now how do I get in there to get to the main? Yeah, you'll have to. You go back into that where the main presentation is. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as I said, this was a lot of this was put together by Scott Dykes and myself, and this is a topic. It's Tennessee amphibians with an emphasis on the current management techniques and conservation issues. So this is very encompassing of a lot of things here. Well, to tell you a little bit, give you some trivia to wow somebody tonight or later in the week, is that Tennessee is the most biodiverse state than any other state without a shoreline. In other words, California, Texas, Florida may have more species, especially of wildlife, than we do in Tennessee, but we don't have an ocean. You know, Alabama has more species than we do, but they have an ocean. A little bit, but they still have an ocean. So they have all the marine animals that they have to take. But Tennessee is a landlocked state. We have a tremendous vertebrate diversity of animals. And I threw this slide up there, these endemic salamanders in the Appalachians. That's sort of what I am very interested in. So I always try to throw that out there when I can. Well, why does Tennessee have this diversity? Well, if you started out, shut this door. I always give an example of if you started out in an automobile in Memphis and you started right up against the Mississippi River, and as far as physical diversity, which I guess this is about burnt out now. Let me try this one. I think this one will work. Yeah, okay. Start out here almost zero sea level here in Memphis in the Mississippi alluvial valley. You just crossed over the Mississippi, Tennessee, and so you're on Interstate 40 and you're heading east. You're going to end up in Roan Mountain. Let's say we're going to drive all the way to Roan Mountain in one day. Just think about the physical diversity that you're going to drive across as you come across the state. You go get into around Jackson. And then you get into what's called the East Gulf Coastal Plain. And you keep on driving on 40, and you come on up to, you really start getting into what you would consider hills. And that's the Western Highland Rim. That's before you get to Nashville. It's out there around Dixon or someplace, I think. And then you start back down into kind of a little bowl, and that's called the Nashville Basin. And if you do have a cereal bowl on the table, it would be where Nashville is. It's down in the bowl, and the Highland Rim surrounds Nashville. So then again, you're still traveling east. You come out on the east side of the Highland Rim out of Nashville, starting to Cookeville. You get in on the, this is the eastern Highland Rim, the very high part of it around Cookeville. Then you go on into the Cumberland Plateau, which is kind of like a mountain by the time you get there. And then as you come down, you pass the time zone now. You're back in the eastern time zone. And you start down the mountain there toward Kingston, Rockwood, Harriman, coming down the mountain, and you're in the Ridge and Valley, where we are now. We're in the Ridge and Valley here. And then we keep on 40, and we go on, and we get up to 81, and we split off of 81, and we go on up to toward Johnson City. Then we take I-26 on the Roan Mountain, and we get to a peak that's over 6,000 feet. Essentially, we've traveled from Florida to Canada, and we've never really left Tennessee. But as far as a biome, or as far as habitats, you went from where there were bald cypress trees and tupelo gum trees, and tremendous amount of wetlands where the amphibians are their zenith, to another place, to Canada. But you trade your Anuin hotspot for salamander hotspots in the Blue Mountains. So So that's a diversity in itself, just the physical landscape. Then if you look at the vegetation types in Tennessee and the slopes and the aspect and the precipitation and all these factors that come into this, little seeps and ponds and creeks and all these things, you get into the wetlands, the different kinds of wetlands that we have in Tennessee. Then in this Nashville Basin area, it's a very unique habitat called a cedar glade or a limestone glade. I prefer the limestone glade more over cedar glade because there's more vegetation in there than cedars. And then you, again, these high elevation areas can have balls and bogs and fens and all kinds of things up there that amphibians really enjoy. So that's why Tennessee is so diverse from both a vegetation and a wildlife populations. Well, amphibian management in East Tennessee is sort of what I'm going to talk to you about, but I wanted to set the stage with this background information. And East Tennessee will include 21 counties here in the eastern time zone. The most southerly of those counties is Monroe County, and then if you travel a line up, it's Loudoun, Anderson, Campbell. And then across the Kentucky line over to you hit Virginia, and then all the way to Johnson County, and then we border North Carolina for these other counties here to the far east. So this is East Tennessee in my definition of East Tennessee. Some people include Crossville and some other lesser known places, but this is East Tennessee for me. Okay, in 2004 we hired, we hired about 10 new people in the wildlife agency to do non-game work. And part of this non-game work was to go out and do inventories on our wildlife management areas. And if you were a shop owner, or you just bought a shop, or you just came in, you would at least like to know what your inventory is. What do you have now in your shop? So that's what we were looking for, is what do we have? Now this is all going to be concentrated on amphibians, but I'll throw a few other slides in here in a minute. So this began in 2004. We had to go, a lot of them, the folks, didn't have a very good background in non-game wildlife, so we had to use a lot of references. And the main reference that we looked for amphibians was this Atlas of Amphibians in Tennessee by Floyd Scott and Bill Redmond. Bill used to work for TVA. He's retired now. Bill got his PhD degree here at the university under Dr. Echternach. And Bill did his PhD on the biogeography of the amphibians, I don't know if it was Tennessee was the title, or it was in the southeastern U.S., but I know it was a biogeography. And then it sort of formed into this atlas that Floyd put together. And this is this particular document is free to you. I think it's free to you. If you write the Austin Peay State University, and then ask Floyd Scott to send you one. He'll probably give you one. And then the other one's not free. You have to go buy this book here, but it's The Measuring and Monitoring of Biological Diversity. It's where we got some of the ideas from some of the ways to sample for amphibians. Well, what we do when we catch a frog or catch a toad or catch a snake or snake's a reptile, catch a salamander, we identify it by using several means. Usually they holler at me if it's a salamander or if it's a frog, most of them know what that is. If it's other creatures, then we go to reference books. But we identify it, we measure the length of it, we weigh it, we try to age it, and that's the hardest part in a lot of these animals, is aging them. And then we try to determine the sex of the animal. Some of the animals are dimorphic, and that's sex. Morphism is the best example I can give you, like a cardinal, where the male is bright red and the female is not, or a bluebird, where the male is brilliantly colored. Well, some of these amphibians, you can tell the males from the females readily, but you have to know a little bit about anatomy. Then we also do the air temperature, soil temperature, and then take the GPS. These are two UT students working. Sitting down, why do you standing up when you can sit down and do the same thing? But their weighing looks like either a salamander or a toad in here. These were interns from last year that we had in the summer. And this was on a bio blitz that we were in Rocky Fork, an area that's really covered up with salamanders. Well, there's several methods that we use to sample to catch these animals. We put out 10, rows of 10, and this 10 can be in an array, kind of like the cover boards here. Actually, 10 and wood are cover boards. The word cover board doesn't necessarily mean wood, cover structure. But we put these out either in a line or an array, depends on the habitat. And then we use those methods. We also use what's called a visual encounter survey. That's so many meters and that's set up, or we do it by time, depending on where we are. And then we also put out drift fences. And I want to show you all these techniques in detail in just a moment. Again, I'm just giving you the background here. And then we also, when we do bats, we put out mist nets. If we're doing birds, we put out mist nets. But the cover boards are good for mammals and reptiles and amphibians. And then we also put out Sherman traps or tomahawk traps. Those are primarily for mammals, but you'd be surprised what you catch in some of these. Sometimes we catch toads and birds, especially wrens, in these traps. But this is just kind of a real busy slide to, and we also do habitat descriptions, and there's other things that we do for this. But a cover board, again, well, cover board is can be wood or tin, and in this case it's wood, and we put a stencil on here, it says TWRA Research, Do Not Disturb, and over on Chuck Swan WMA, I think these things are giant frisbees for some people in the woods. They like to see how far they can throw them down slope, and we have to go pick them up and put them back and all this, but it really doesn't do much good to put that on there. I think it just makes people more curious. These are 2 feet by 2 feet square wood. And we chose that because it was just easier to handle. Some people like larger boards. And then we have 10. To put these boards out, you have to prepare the ground. You take a rake and rake the vegetation back and then lay them down on bare ground. And this was a place that we did out in West Tennessee. And these were three of these folks here were interns from year before last. John Davenport is now over at East Carolina working on his PhD. He's doing work with ambistomid salamanders and some of the small anurans over there. And this is Misty. She's, don't know where I happened to Misty. I think she's in anthropology in South Dakota. This is Jesse Helton from Jefferson County. Jesse was a volunteer, and now Jesse is doing his master's thesis at Tennessee Tech University on aquatic organisms and some statistical stuff. He like Dr. Gray's in math. He likes math. So I think you'll get to meet Jesse sometime soon here.
Yeah, he's coming with us on the...
Yeah, Jesse is... Jesse's heart lies with amphibians, but he just has to do this for to make a living, what he's doing now. Let's see, where... Okay. All right, I miss... Oh, yeah, here's... These cover boards here are over at Forks of the River Wildlife Management, just across the river here in South Knox County. And this is an array. Now, this is what the sun does to some of these. They warp, so they're not as effective, especially if they're out in the bright sun. And then also, this is a limestone barren area almost up there, very shallow soils. I'm sure that the ground temperature gets a lot higher there than it does in other places. Well, there's from both, all three. It's expensive, it's toxic, and then the other thing is we're trying this, it's a Vitek or something like that. We've got some of that the company has given us some scraps, but as long as they meet our specifications. And they're using those in the Cumberland Plateau kind as an area to test the prototype, and we still haven't gotten results back yet, still. Yeah, and you know, people like to gather that stuff up too and hobble it up for tree houses and everything else. No, I think it's Scott. Scott's a technical person on that. Well, we do catch salamanders under these boards. This is a spotted salamander, and you catch quite a few of those, especially during the breeding season. And I'll get into the natural history of these animals here in a little while. But these animals primarily live underground most of the time of the year, and they come up to breed, and that's when we usually catch them. And let's see, there's a close relative that's called the marbled salamander. And we don't see many of those. They're not real common in terms of numbers. The populations are just not that high. Whereas with spotted salamanders, you might catch 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 of those animals. It depends on the site you're on during the breeding season. But with the marbled salamander, you don't catch that many, usually less than 10 or 12. Now, when the eggs start hatching, you get a lot of larvae when they start moving out, or a lot of metamorphous animals. Well, that's not a salamander. That's a white-footed mouse, a Paramiscus sp. I don't know which one, white-footed deer mouse, but they will build a nest under these boards, and they will raise their young. This was one that Scott said that she came running out of there, and they just were still hanging on to her. And you see they're almost ready to wean there. But you catch quite a few mammals under these boards, or see a lot of them. You see more than you actually catch. Well, another technique is the drift fence. The drift fence is very labor intensive. You usually dig a trench and you put this tin or flashing, this is aluminum flashing, and you anchor it down, and we had a lot of this stolen. Chuck Swan again. Chuck Swan's not a real hospitable place if you're trying to do research. But you place buckets at the end of these, the terminus, I guess, of these pit of the wings that go out, and that's where the pit fall comes in. There are 5-gallon buckets you put in the ground, and the animal gets will come walking in and get to the fence. It'll either go right or left, or maybe turn around and go back the other way. But if it goes right or left in this situation, it'll follow the fence down, and then sometimes it'll fall over in the bucket. And that's how we catch them in these buckets. There's Scott looking in a bucket. There's the bucket in the ground. This is a woodland pitfall set. There's the lid of the bucket. We put the lids on when we're not using them. Well, this thing's very sensitive. But you catch a lot of mammals in these pitfalls. This is a vole. That's the vole. This is this vole right here. This is a short-tailed shrew, northern short-tailed shrew. This is one of the Sorex, genus Sorex. It's either a long, southeastern shrew or one of those long-tailed shrews. This one here is venomous, and they eat a lot of salamanders. They will catch and eat them. This one has a venom in their submaxillary salivary glands.
How bad is it?
What?
How bad is it?
Well, in Terry Vaughn's book, the mammalogy book, that says it, that there's enough venom in there to kill 200 mice in one adult northern short-tailed shrew. Now, if it bit you, it'd probably sting, and it's a neurotoxic venom. And so it wouldn't, you know, cause any swelling or anything, but it would cause some pain. And I don't know how they come up with that figure of 200 mice. But in the winter, these mammals will eat voles. They'll eat mice and voles, which voles are not voles. V-O-L-S is voles. V-O-L-E-S is voles. The shrews will eat voles, and they do weigh more than the shrew. That's another talk. It's mammalogy. I'm getting off here. But anyway, very interesting animals. But they do eat salamanders, and they eat snails. But so you have to be careful if you've got salamanders and a mammal in the same bucket, because the mammal usually will prevail. Now, that being said, the tiger salamander and the spotted salamander will eat mice. At least in the literature, they say they will. Well, this is John Mike at Chuck Swan WMA. When he's not looking for people stealing our stuff, he comes out sometimes and helps us. This is a spotted salamander that they found in probably a visual encounter survey, which means you just go out and look for stuff. You go out and you flip logs, you flip rocks, you rake leaves. You look under ledges, you visually encounter the animal. And again, these are usually on transects, which is a straight line. But a straight line is never a straight line in the woods, because you have to always meander through there over old stumps and logs and that sort of thing. Or you do it by time. In other words, you just search an area and you say, we're going to search this area for 20 minutes or 15 minutes. And so you just kind of search it the best you can, saturate the area, and come up with what you what you find, then you take the GPS coordinates and all that. And sometimes you can find a lot of variety of things. This is a red-spotted newt, and these have toxic skin secretions on their skin. So if you handle them, don't put your hands in your eyes or your mouth, because you could. A lot of amphibians do that, but these particularly are pretty nasty.
Do they have it when they're in the eft?
Yeah, I think they have it, especially in the eft, because they're red, and that's a warning to predators not to eat them. This is a little narrow-mouthed toad. You don't see those very often. I don't know. Populations in East Tennessee are not real high, at least. We don't know very many populations in this part of the state. The further you go west, and again, the higher you find the densities, at least. And this is a bullfrog or green frog. Can anybody tell me? Which one's this one? Bullfrog or green frog? Why do you think it's a bullfrog? Right here tells you this deal right there.
Don't have
what? Probably not as prominent, but this little fold right there, it's a bullfrog, I think. Is this a male or a female turtle?
Male.
Why do you think it's a male? Okay, it has a 20% chance of being a red-eyed female. 20% of these turtles can be females with red eyes. So we put them down as male, but how accurate that is, I don't know.
Can you tell by the plastron?
You can, but just by eye color. If you're going by eye color alone, 20% can be female. All right, this is the largest salamander by weight in Tennessee is the eastern hellbender. Don't change your answer. This one was up in Unicoi County, and we weighed it, measured it, and released it. It's a large animal. It's a salamander, a very ancient creature. Cryptobranchus means hidden gills. You don't see the gills in this, and it's a totally aquatic animal. Most that are totally aquatic, you can see the gills, like the mud puppy and the Tennessee cave salamander, or some of those other ones. You can't see it in the hellbender. Well, we've made some unusual finds since 2004. This is a two-tailed, long-tail salamander. And, you know, it must have had an injury there at the base of the tail here, and if it grew this second tail. You know, it must have thought it lost that tail. Shrew probably bit it or something, but it caused it to grow two tails. And it's a very weird-looking thing when it's moving around. Came from Jefferson County. Well, let's see. Yonelosi salamanders was an unusual find. And it's hard. A lot of people cannot grasp this concept. To me, it was very exciting, because if you look right here, we knew of these populations of Yonelosi. Here's the whole worldwide planet, universal. As far as we know, the whole universe, the population is only in Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. But none had ever been found south of the Nolichucky River. And the reason that I got so excited, and I still think it's an extraordinary find, is because if you believe in adaptation of these animals, and these are lungless salamanders, and you go back in time to the Pleistocene, we go back 10,000 years ago, the Nolichucky River was probably wider than the Mississippi River at that time, because it was draining the glaciated areas when we were going through a global warming at that time. Well, no populations had ever been found back then. You have to think about the barrier that river would have been for a little 9-inch, 6-inch salamander trying to cross a mile-wide river. Well, to me, that's an extraordinary find. They've never been found south of the Nolichucky River. And also, the population that we found, this is what they look like. Very, very beautiful animals. It's the Cadillac of salamanders, in my opinion. They lived in these crevices, in rock crevices, whereas most Yonelosis that I have ever seen, and I've been in the woods a long time, and I've looked under a lot of things looking for them, are either in the leaf litter, they're either in rotting logs, or stumps that are rotting or under moss. That's where you find them. That's where I've always found them. I've never found them in rock crevices. Now, there are two of their cousins, one down in Georgia, it's called the Pigeon Mountain Salamander, it looks very close to this, lives in rocks. There's one over in western North Carolina that's called Plethodon petraeus that lives in rock crevices. And I don't know what the, I think it's called crevice salamander. It's a very close relative to this one, but it's a different species. So, you know, do we have a different species? I don't know. But this was one that Josie Harris found in Rocky Fork last year. This picture doesn't do it justice, but it has a very different look as far as morphologically. The phenotype, the physical look of this animal is a lot different than most young lices I've ever seen. And we found a whole lot more this year because we started looking in rock crevices for them. So we know they're there, and they're very low elevations too. So that was, I thought, was a very unusual find. Again, just another picture. This is Dr. Tom Laughlin at East Tennessee State University. And Dr. Laughlin will be doing a project looking at the genetics of these animals to see how closely related these are that we found to the other populations in Virginia and North Carolina. Another animal that we found that was rather unusual, at least the place that we found it, was this western lesser siren up in Campbell County at Cove Lake State Park. Now, here's the worldwide known range of the western siren. It's a coastal plain thing. It goes up the Mississippi Valley. And then look in Tennessee here. This is all, you know, everything is west of Nashville. Everything is way west of Nashville. And then we found this thing here in Campbell County. Don't know how it got there or what it's doing there, but it's there. And they're a very unusual looking amphibian. They only have front legs. They don't have rear legs. They almost look like an eel. Sometimes fishermen catch them and they call them eels, but it's not an eel, it's a salamander. And they're up there in Cove Lake of all places. We think they probably got there by fishermen's bait buckets, but we don't know. Another population is this. We did this poster here recently. Scott Dykes did, mainly. Is the tiger salamander, Ambystoma tigrinum. And tiger salamanders have a huge range. Look at the range in the United States. It's gigantic. It's probably one of the largest ranges, at least, distributions, at least, of any salamander in North America. But if you looked at Tennessee, if you came down to here, it cuts off here, right here at the ridge and valley, except for this population that we knew that was in Knox County, which was from the 1940s. I don't know if anybody's found them in about 60 years. But we found the population in Jefferson County on an island right there in Douglas Lake. And if you come and look at this, you can see the unusual position that this animal is in. Anyway, we found them there, and they're very handsome. It's the largest terrestrial salamander in Tennessee. And they have the largest larvae, huge larvae with gills. And we found them in May of 2006. They drained a pond there. And this is the pond that was drained. And this was what was left of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of larvae that after the coons and the birds found them. And I was just reading today in the literature that these animals will eviscerate them and eat the insides, but they don't eat the skin. Again, it's because of toxic secretions. So that's why they were leaving these carcasses. They were eating the soft body parts that leave in the carcass. Raccoons especially would do that. So I guess this was raccoon. Talking about raccoons. Jeremy Hamilton and Jonathan Walls were saying this pond and we found those larvae last year. And this is what the pond looks like when it's full. This is the big pond. And then this year we went back, had Chris Ogle with us, a UT student. We had a couple of other volunteers. This is Emily Grossclose right there. And this is a spotted salamander. We found two spotted salamanders. Found the adult until this year. Actually, this is the first tiger salamander I ever held in my hand. They're very secretive. They live underground almost all of their life. This is an egg mass. It looks like snot on a stick. It's the most jellyfied egg mass you know, wood frog eggs are jellyfied, but they're almost gelatin-like. These are just like runny jello. And they're real small. They're, as you see, this is the palm of a small person's hand. You know, they're real small. There's probably 50 or 60 eggs in there. Whereas spotted salamanders, you'll get several hundred eggs, at least, in a big egg mass, and it's almost like gelatin, congealed jello. But this, they're very different. The egg masses are very different. We found over 200 egg masses this spring when we relocated the eggs from one pond about 150 yards to another pond. Because they drain this one, TWRA puts fish in here. And the fish are worth more to them than the salamanders are so far. And the green tree frog record that we found in Knox County over on Seven Islands. We were out doing bat work one night. Scott had waded out in this muddy water and set his mist nets up for bats. And all of a sudden we heard this creature calling, and I looked at him and he looked at me and I said, "That can't be what I think it is." And he says, "I think it is." And so Scott walked over into the weeds and kept looking, his eagle eye. He's an ex-Marine, so he really has an eye for detail in the swamp. And he found this creature here. It was hard to find. You can see how it blends in. But it's a green tree frog, and they're not supposed to be here. They're supposed to be out in West Tennessee, but this one is in Knox County. And we photographed it, weighed it, measured it, and released it back. Well, we didn't find this, but the study was done in the Cumberland Plateau. And I think this goes back to 2003. This is on the front page of the Knoxville paper in 2003. Now, look here. You know, the front page is UT football in 2003. But up in the corner is this little salamander, new to science. This is Desmognathus abditus. And Dr. Tilley split this one out of the Desmognathus ocropheus group in 2000, I guess it says 2003 here. I think he actually did it a little later, or earlier than that. But even 10 years before that, in 1994 roughly, he split out four other species out of this Desmognathus ocropheus group, which was called at that time mountain dusky salamanders. And now they've had to change them, all their names to, this one is called the Cumberland Dusky Salamander, Cumberland Mountain Dusky Salamander, Desmognathus abditus, and it's rather small. It's probably 3 to 4 inches long, something like that, tail, head, and all. It's not a very big animal, but it's new. It was new to science in 2003, made the front page. I thought that was rather neat. Well, other things that you find are, this is a four-toed salamander, which more than likely is going to be found in the edges of wet areas, in swamps and bogs, under sphagnum moss. You find them under moss lots of times. And when the females are laying their eggs, they will stay with their clutch of eggs and kind of stay with them for a while. But this one, I was doing a visual encounter survey down in Middle Tennessee in Franklin County, and found this thing on a ridge under an old house site. It was a foundation of a house, and there were old boards and cinder blocks, and I was pulling those off. I was looking for a snake was what I was after. I thought there had to be snake habitat. And I flipped a board, and there was this big, fat, you tell how fat they are by how thick their tail is, of this four-toed salamander. It wasn't in the habitat that you think it's going to be in. So amphibians will sometimes trick you. And y'all have already had a lecture on Tennessee cave salamander and the genetics that's going on. Well, I just wanted to throw this in. I didn't know that prior to this, but we think that we have a whole lot more species out there in these caves, that the cave causes endemism or speciation in each cave. The genetics, they're isolated, so there could be more of these animals out there than what we already know. Yep. Well, I think Dr. Gray has some upcoming lectures for you where he'll really get into detail on the chytrid fungus and the rhinoviruses. I know he's been very well into that in his time in Tennessee. He's been looking at a lot of these things that are affecting populations of our native amphibians. And then there's also the water quality and habitat issues facing salamanders and frogs and toads. This is a black-bellied salamander egg deposition on the bottom of a rock, and they have to have very highly oxygenated, very clean water for these little salamanders to metamorphose. And if they don't have that, then they die. They desiccate or die. And then there's also other fungus that attacks them, and the mother can't fend them off. She can fight off aquatic insects, but she can't fight off fungus and bacteria, although there has been some studies show that there is some fungicide in the skin secretion she can give them. But anyway, these are some issues as far as the future goes, especially the habitat and the water quality. Do you all have any questions at this point on this particular aspect of my talk today?
Well, did all your questions are correct from earlier?
Yeah, I only answered just one or two in there, didn't I?
Did we get the smallest native Tennessee salamander?
I didn't get to that yet. I haven't got to the salamander lecture yet. It's coming up. Any questions? I'm not going to let you go early. I've got all kinds of stuff to tell you tonight. So even if you don't ask questions, you're going to be here. What time do they usually get out?
7:30.
7:30, so we got about an hour. No questions? Well, this is the email. I put it up there on the board, but this is my email and Scott Dykes' email if you would like to email us if you don't feel comfortable asking the question in front of everybody. That's that. I'll leave that up there for a moment, and then if I can get Dr. Ray to show me how to pull up the salamander.
And Keith, are y'all ever looking for volunteers? One part of this class, of course outside of this class, folks can volunteer, I'm sure, anytime, but part of this class, they get extra credit for volunteering. And maybe after y'all have gotten your grades back from your first test, you might be interested. I don't know. But would y'all be interested and open to volunteers?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot that could be done, especially if we could work out an individual type of thing out at the Forks of the River. It's so close to campus, so close to here, that they could run out early in the morning or in the afternoon or even at night if you're actually a volunteer. Otherwise, you can't be on the area at night. But we have built some ponds out there that we'd like to see what's calling in those ponds. We haven't had anybody do that. I mean, even if you wanted to do something else, you could do some habitat work. We have some cover boards out there. You could run those. Just don't handle any venomous snakes, regardless of your religion. Just don't handle them as a volunteer for us. We don't want you doing that. And there is a possibility that there are copperheads out there. But there's black rat snakes. We've had decay snake out there, smooth earth snake, rough green snake, corn snake, and all these. You have to leave the snakes there, but you can document them on your checklist and give it. If you really wanted to do volunteer work, you can use it. Yeah, if you get the salamanders, and then we can, we'll take a break, and then do, if you wanted me to do the frogs and toads. Bob English took that picture. That's really
good.
Yeah. Okay, most of these photographs and a lot of the PowerPoint presentation itself was done by Lisa Powers, who at the time was a volunteer for the Wildlife Resources Agency. And if you go to tnwildlife.org, there are links that you can follow to her salamander page. It's changed now. It's a lot better format than what she had put on this. This was a very old one. This goes back to probably 6 or 7 years ago. But you can actually download it and have your own Salamanders of Tennessee PowerPoint. And it has a lot more information than I can give you on each individual animal. But it's from Lisa Powers. And I didn't do these fonts. She did that. So if you have a headache at the end of this talk, it's not my fault. I'm just here to bring the message. All right, there are at least 60 salamanders in Tennessee. probably closer to 75, but there's at least 60 species in our state. So that was a question. How many of you got close? Anybody? How close did you get?
62.
That's good. There's at least 60. Whoa. Okay. Now, Lisa, again, she's a lot more philosophical than I am, and so some of these things are very, I don't know, she puts it in a lot different verbiage than I would. But anyway, salamanders are tailed amphibians. They do not all lay their eggs in water. They're not always biphasic. All frogs lay their eggs in water. All anurans lay their eggs in water, in Tennessee at least. Not all salamanders lay their eggs in water. So that's, in a sense, it's almost an oxymoron for an amphibian, because people think that amphibians are all biphasic and lay their eggs in water, or have at least an aquatic stage, and they don't all do that. But they all are cold-blooded, and they all have this glandular skin. They lack claws, and they must have moisture to survive. They must live in a moist environment, a high humidity, high precipitation usually. Well, unless you've been living in under a rock, you have heard about the amphibian declines in worldwide. And probably this golden toad from down in Costa Rica, I believe it was in Costa Rica, was discovered in 1967, then it disappeared just in 87, 20 years. It's gone. They have no clue as to what happened to it, where it is. And you think, well, yeah, that's down in a subtropical area. It probably was acid precipitation. It was probably some kind of global thing. Well, we don't know. Because it could have been a virus. We don't know. Well, you know, it would never happen in Tennessee. We would never just lose a species because of anything like that. Well, it happened in North Carolina. There was a frog over there called Raina. I think it was Hirschrich eye, the river frog. They haven't been seen in North Carolina for over 10 years. We don't know what happened to them. None of the herpetologists can figure it out. It's not water quality. Was it viruses? Who knows what it was? We don't know. So extinctions can happen without really an explanation. Well, all these red dots there are extinctions. And then the yellow dots are where these animals are declining, and or something unexplainable is going on or in these populations. And it's all over the globe. It's not just in the subtropics, it's all over the globe. Well, a lot of attention has been given to the frog declines, but very little has been given to salamanders as far as attention in research and other studies, except for maybe in the southern Appalachians. And there's a lot of reasons why we should be concerned about salamanders. They are a barometer, I think, of the health of the environment. They have a key role in ecosystems. The stability, you know, they usually live in stable environments. So if they start blinking out, if they start going extinct, then that means that their environment's not stable anymore. And we may be the next one to do the same thing. They're very sensitive to air and water pollution, and they can measure the change that's going on in both the air and the water. And then the rarity of these animals, just the threatened endangered status. You know, we need to make sure that we monitor these populations. And then Lisa put this in there. They're really pretty animals. They are all have their inherent beauty, and they appeal to conservationists and people that like to study amphibians. Well, some of these declines have been, reasons for the decline have been climate change, definitely. Habitat modification, yes. Fragmentation of habitats. That's where you could have a very pristine habitat, but if the area, it's like this island here in Douglas Lake, it's a pristine island, but that's all it is. All around it is literally a freshwater ocean, Douglas Lake. And salamanders can't live in a lake, at least tiger salamanders, because they're terrestrial. And then around the shoreline, around the island, are, you know, $250,000, $500,000 homes with manicured lawns, with fertilized, a lot of pavement, A lot of lawn mowing going on, so you really can't use that as a habitat, so it's fragmented in that respect. Introduced species, this can be both parasites, can be introduced into populations. People that go to the pet shop out here off of Sutherland Avenue and buy a fire newt, and they take it home and they say, you know, I'm getting tired of changing this cage on this thing, I'm just going to turn it loose. I think I'll take it over to the pond and turn it loose. So they take it over to the pond and they turn it loose. A fire newt is not a native amphibian for Tennessee. So what kind of pathogens did this fire newt have? What kind of viruses did it have? What kind of fungus was on it? What kind of parasites, internal or external, was on it that they turn it loose? So that's an introduced species, but it also has a more of a calamity than just being the species competing with another. UV radiation, that's the sunlight. With the ozone depletion, it could cause some serious problems to animals that breathe through their skin and need moisture and less sunlight on them. Chemical contaminants, I talked about fertilized and change. We've seen in reptile populations, especially the alligator, of what they call the feminization of male alligators because of the estrogens in the chemicals that they're taking in, and they're behaving more like females than they are males. So chemical contaminants can have a detrimental effect on breeding populations. Again, disease, and then the trade in amphibians as pets. That can be directly affecting some populations because if you're a little salamander and somebody grabs you up and puts you in a pizza box and ships you to Florida, then you're directly affected. And the population that you live in is directly affected. So these are things that we have to worry about. Well, these are just definitions getting into a lot more detail than I want to get into right here. But like I said, you can download this for yourself. Okay, we know that we have over 60 species, probably more like 75, of salamanders belonging to 7 different families. Whoop. So we're going to start with these ambystomids. That's the tiger salamander and all their cousins. We have 6 species here in Tennessee in this family. And that's pretty diverse. That's a pretty high diversity. We only have 9 lizard species all told. All total, we have 9 lizards, which are reptiles, but we have 6 ambystomid salamanders, which is pretty good. Okay. Ambystomid barberi, this is a streamside salamander, probably needs to be federally listed as a threatened animal because of the habitat that it lives in. The development around Rutherford and Cannon and Davidson counties is ridiculous. And that's the restriction of the range of this species in Tennessee. It's found other places in the world, but in Tennessee it's very restricted to the Nashville Basin. They're called the streamside salamander, as the name implies, it lives in streams. It's unusual from this in the family. Most of them live they live underground, but it breeds in streams. But most of them deposit their eggs in vernal pools and egg masses. This guy here, the female, will deposit the eggs underneath rocks, underneath, I think, vegetation, not on sticks in water, so in water that moves, which is unusual for this group of animals. But it is a very robust salamander, kind of chunky. This is a close relative, very common in Tennessee. People just don't see very, very often. But when they do, they freak out. They don't know what they've got. They've got a Loch Ness monster in the basement of their house. If someone has a dirt basement and they come out and see it with a flashlight, they really freak out. It's a spotted salamander. As the name implies, it has these big yellow spots on it. You'll see them in royal blue quite often in the breeding season, crossing the roads or in these little ditches breeding. The marble salamander, I showed you pictures of that one earlier. It's not as common as the spotted. It's a little shorter, a little smaller salamander, chunkier. They breed in the fall, not in the spring. So they breed in the fall. If you see egg masses in vernal pools in the fall, it's probably the Ambystoma opacum, or the marble salamander. Fall breeders. The other ones are spring breeders. This is the mole salamander, or Talpodium. Talpodium. You find the only place I know that they breed is down toward Arnold Air Force Base in Coffee County. They're very weird looking. Then the smallmouth salamander, Texanum, find those especially in the western part of the state. into the Nashville Basin. Again, it's in this family, these big chunky fossorial salamander. They live underground 90% of the time, then they come up only to breed. And then the big cat daddy of all is this tiger salamander. Huge animal as far as terrestrial, the largest terrestrial salamander in Tennessee. The Amphiumas, we have one species in Tennessee, three species in the whole world, but only one in Tennessee. And we went down to West Tennessee last year and captured one. It was this amphibia web, what do they call it? It's in Berkeley. What is it? You know the name of that group out there? It's they're doing studies on salamanders worldwide. They didn't have a specimen at all from Tennessee, and the West Tennesseans didn't. It was beneath their dignity to go catch one for them. So we went all the way out there, caught one, drove all the way back, and put it in a milk jug, a plastic milk jug, put water in there, put it in UPS, and shipped it to them. They got it alive, and they still have it alive on exhibit out there. But anyway, go back. Amphiumas. This is an amphiuma. They'll bite you. And they're very long. They can get up to about like this. You know, they're real long. They have these little T-Rex, which am I doing here? These little T-Rex appendages on the, this is a little leg. They're useless. They've got little legs on the front and little legs on the back. But they just look like little catfish barbels or something. They don't even look like legs. But this is an amphiuma. They're real long. They're considered eels. They call them conger eels out in West Tennessee. You'll find them in Real Foot Lake, in those ditches out through Real Foot, you find them. They're fairly common. Fishermen catch them quite often. Three-toed amphiuma. They have little bitty feet, but it's kind of, they're like T-Rex. They're really useless little feet. They can't walk with them. They squirm and slither.
They have teeth?
Teeth? Yeah. Oh yeah, they have teeth, yeah. Yeah, the teeth are effective. They can bite you, pinch you more. Well, the Cryptobranchus, I showed you that one. That's the largest salamander by weight. The Amphiuma would be the largest by length, but this one's by weight. And we have one species in Tennessee. This one was, we caught it up in Granger County. A fisherman caught it and brought it to us, and it was a Granger County record. We'd never had a record of that, and I don't know how big this one, I can't remember. I can't even see that. 8, 9, 10, 11, 11. Something like that. I guess that's inches. There's 10, 11. There's a foot. So, whatever that is. There's a pocket knife. That helps you. One of the guys had to lay a pocket knife down. We don't know how big the pocket knife was. Anyway, this one was from Granger County, and it was a record, and it was in the reservoir, which is unusual, where the creek comes in. And it was the only record that we had from that county.
How do you find those?
How do you?
Yeah.
Well, the best way to find them is to go to places that you might think that they exist at night, put on a snorkel, and snorkel, and flip over rocks. Their primary diet is crayfish. They love crayfish. And so you have to flip over rocks and look for them then there while they're feeding for crayfish. But at night, if you look at them, you know, if you go see when you go back, they you really can't see an eye on there. They don't really hunt by eyesight. We figure it's by smell or possibly by electrical impulses. Crayfish give off electrical impulses. Star-nosed mole, that's how the star-nosed mole finds them, and that's their primary diet. That's how the duck-billed platypus finds them, and that's their primary diet. It's worms and crayfish, and they give off little low-level electrical impulses. So maybe this thing can pick that up, but you have to go out in streams and look for them at night. You can find them during the day, and we occasionally find them electrofishing some of the streams when they do fish sampling. But most of the time, if you're really serious, you have to go out at night. And J.R. Shute, you ever met J.R. Shute, Wolf Creek Conservation Fisheries over here? His wife, Peggy, is with the TVA, but they're mostly ichthyologists. But J.R. was snorkeling in Abrams Creek one night, and he and Pat Rakes, and he said that it was a real bizarre night, that there was these thunderstorms all around. They didn't see any lightning, but they could hear the thunder. They said he was snorkeling, and he turned over a rock. He was looking for mad toms, little catfish. And he said about the time that he turned this rock over, this big hellbender came up and got right in his face, and then there was a lightning bolt that came up and lit up the whole world, and he said it was one of those moments, you know, that he got out of the pool. But they got out and took all their stuff, but he told me about that, and that was a record for Abert Creek. I didn't know they were that far up. But anyway, it's the largest salamander that we have by weight. Now we're getting into these lungless salamanders, the family Plethodontidae, and that's Desmognathus is one genus, and then Plethodon is another. There are other genera there, but the two primary genera are Plethodontids, or Plethodon, and Desmognathus. Those are the two that where most of them are going to fall in that category. All right, here is one of the smallest salamanders in Tennessee. This is Desmognathus enus, or the seepage salamander. There is Desmognathus right eye, which is the pygmy salamander. And then the Cherokee salamander, which is Desmognathus something or another. We'll maybe see. Those three probably tie the record for the smallest terrestrial vertebrate in Tennessee. And probably getting real close to the smallest vertebrate is the mosquito fish, but it may not be a native, so these guys may have it. But this is a Desmognathus that lays its eggs out of water. The right eye also lays its eggs usually either in a little seepy areas, but usually out of water. And that's not a characteristic of that genus. That's not a very good picture, but it's about as good as you'll ever see. That's a mother guarding her eggs. And these salamanders will do that. A lot of salamanders, the terrestrial salamanders especially, and some of the aquatics, will guard their eggs in this family. And they guard their eggs from predators, they guard their eggs from other salamanders, they guard their eggs whenever the water goes down, they keep exuding fluid on them. Sometimes they can get them to hatch. And then if they can get them into a little aquatic situation, salamanders are born. Well, the dusky salamanders is a whole different group. As I said before, they've been split out here recently, and a lot of species there. Carolinensis, Kanani, Fuscus. Let's see, what's the other one that used to be Acrophius, which is a mountain dusky, and then there is Carolinensis. And there's one that they just recently, I can never remember that one. But anyway, this is a generic dusky salamander. They all look like this. You really have to know them. And there's little subtle things like this keeled tail. You know, the tail being keeled. And if you look in Conant and Collins' field guide, 1991, they have a thing in there that says that learning Desmognathus salamanders, especially these duskies, is like learning fall warblers. It's the warblers that don't have the feather coloration in the fall like they do in the summer. But anyway, you really have to know your salamanders if you get into the dusky salamander group. The imitator salamander, which is this one right here, is Desmognathus imitator. Now, when y'all go to the Smokies, is Jesse going to be leading you up there? And Ben, okay. You can really wow them. They will not know that you're going to know this. These animals are almost identical. But a Plethodon, the genus Plethodon, has little skinny hind legs. Little skinny hind legs. Desmognathus have hind legs like Papa. They're real muscular, real thick, real bulky. That would separate the two out. That's the first thing to look for. Now, the coloration on the imitator cheek patch is never as bright or never as raised. It doesn't look like a bad wart. It looks more like just a little color patch, like a faded tattoo. Whereas the one on the Plethodon is much raised. It looks like a bad wart. And this is a very general characteristic, and it's one that you won't find in a book. But if you look at them side by side like this, the eyes of a Plethodon are much larger in proportion. because they are a nocturnal predator. And these Desmognathus guys live in water most of the time. They really don't need great big eyes. They just got to be good catchers of things swimming. But these are two separate species, and they've radiated differently over time to look like one another. Now, this Cephalodon jordani here has been split out into this red cheek is only found in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It's not found outside the park anywhere. But jordani has been split out now to Plethodon metcalfi, Plethodon montanus, Plethodon something. There are about five more other Plethodons. Shermani, I think, is out of that group. So anyway, there's a whole lot of these have been split out. Imitator still stayed in there. It's just old imitator. It only imitates the red cheek, and the only place you find the imitator is in the Smoky Mountains National Park. It's not found outside. Shovelnose salamander used to be called Luragnathus marmoratus. It's now called Desmognathus marmoratus. And the only difference in this one and a lot of the other desmogs is that the musculature on the lower jaw is much different. But these guys are extremely aquatic. I've never ever seen one out on the stream bank or anywhere else other than in a stream. And they like pretty fast moving water. Streams that are probably 2 to 5 meters wide. They like a pretty good size, fast flowing stream. I'll get the hang of this in a minute. This is Desmognathus monticular, called the seal salamander. And I never understood why they were called that, but I was reading the book, I think it was Amphibians and Reptiles of West Virginia, and they talk about that they usually will be in the splash zone of these mountain streams where the water splashes out on the rocks, and they sit right in that splash zone. And they look like the seals, the sea lions, on the coast, on the Pacific coast. That's how they got their common name, is they look like seals sitting on those rocks. And they do. If you ever come upon a stream and you see a salamander sitting out on the rock where the water's splashing it, it's more than likely a very high percentage that it's the seal salamander, Desmognathus monticola. And they've stayed in there. They've never split any of them out. Here's the Ocoee salamander. That's another one of those that used to be a mountain dusky. It's a real pretty little thing. It's got a lot of color on its back, but it's very restricted to the range. Genetically, if you look at that paper, a lot of them are on these little mountaintop islands. And so they've split them out. And this is my favorite. This is a black-bellied salamander. They can live to be over 30 years of age. They have to be about 8 years old before they're reproductively mature. And as their name implies, their belly is as black as coal. And they're pretty large. They're the largest of the Desmognathines. They're the largest of the Desmogs. And those were the eggs I showed you earlier was laid by this particular female. And she was very reluctant to leave her clutch. This was taken up in Rock Creek in Unicoi County. She was a real handsome. And they use them for fish bait. It's the number one salamander that's used for fish bait. And I did a spinoff study of that, looking at bait shops, and it's really, it really hurts you to go in there. You know, maybe it doesn't, but it bothered me to go in there and see these great big females that were probably 10, 12 years old in these buckets, and they were going to stick a hook in there and throw them out and catch a bass. And I guess the bigger they are, the bigger fish they're going to catch with them. Maybe. There's these eggs. That was her eggs. Welteri is the black mountain salamander, and we have the world record at the office in Marstown that we collected on Royal Blue. It was an area that they had found this animal up there. The storm had come through and this animal was crawling around, and they found it and brought it to me, and then we photographed it, and the longer we kept it, the more I didn't think we could turn it back loose. So we kept it. This is not a real good picture. I need to get the picture of the one we've got up there. It's bigger than the record in Conant and Collins' book. The pygmy salamander is one of the smallest, probably the smallest. You can put that down. Very small. Again, it's one that's the least of the aquatic Desmognathus group. You find these are almost semi-arboreal, especially after a rain on a real humid night. You go out into the woods at night with your headlamp, and you'll find these little guys up on trees. They climb way high up on the trees, and I'm sure they're hunting. They're looking for something. And then we found a little population that was, there was a little ledge up on the Unaka Mountain about 5,000 feet, and a female had been there, and they had these little larvae. They were teeny tiny little things, about the size of hemlock needles. Real small little guys. Well, this tribe, Hemidactylum, is getting into what's the genus Eurasia, which is another genus in this lungless group. And these are the same genus as the cave salamander, not Tennessee cave, but the cave salamander that you were talking about. You'll probably see those. They're red, real orangish red with black spots. You'll see them in that cave if there's any over there. We have the southern two line, and there's the three line, salamander Eurasia. And then the Junaluska, that's a very rare animal. Probably should be threatened federally because of a very, very restricted range. It's only down in Monroe County along the Teleco River. This is Long Jacata. That's the long tail salamander. That was the one that we had, the split tails, two tails, long tail. This is a cave salamander. Now, can't really see that, but the males on their nostrils have these little fleshy projections during the mating season that comes down, and they're called a cirri, C-I-R-R-I, or cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S would be one, and cirri is the plural. And they think, scientists, biologists, herpetologists think that they use those to detect pheromones from the females. They look like little double-trunked elephants when you see them, and they're very apparent when you look at them. And that whole group has them, that whole group of Eurasia. But the ones you see them on prominent, more than any of them, is the cave salamander. Now this is the Blue Ridge Two Line, and these guys, you can't really describe how pretty they are until you see one. This is as bright gold as any gold, shiny gold you've ever seen. And this stripe is as black as any black, jet black stripe you've ever seen. They're really a handsome salamander. They also use those in the Cumberland Plateau to fish for red eye, fish bait.
What are the restrictions?
Well, they're so complicated, I can't tell you right now because they're in the process of revamping them. But a lot of it has to do, you can only collect the bait to fish with in the watershed that you're fishing in. It don't make any sense. But the only one that you can legally sell or legally buy is Desmognathus fuscus, which is a northern dusky salamander. It's not necessarily considered a game animal, but it's a commercial species.
So can anybody collect salamanders?
If you have a fishing license, you can. Yeah, but you better read the regulations closely. Again, you have to be in the watershed that you're in. You can't possess them only but to fish, and you have to release them once you get through fishing and all this. It's pretty restrictive right now. Tennessee's official state amphibian is the Tennessee cave salamander. Spring salamanders are Gyrinophilus, the group Gyrinophilus. They were used, I guess, as a surrogate for some captive breeding studies. And this, the Blue Ridge, one of these, the Blue Ridge Spring Salamander, has this very distinct line on the nose to the eye. So again, if you see one of those in the Smokies, it's probably the Blue Ridge Spring. This is the four-toed, has this restriction on the tail, this constriction on the tail, and four toes on the hind feet, and the belly is white with black spots. Four toes, white. The only salamander we have that has a belly or underneath a venter like this, that color. Midland mud salamander should be called the red salamander, but it's not. This is the mud salamander, Pseudotriton, the genus Pseudotriton. Here is the larval stage. The spring salamander has a larval stage identical to this, as does the red salamander, Pseudotriton rubra. And the ones we have here in the Smokies has a black chin. If you flip this animal over, it looks like it rubbed his chin in shoe polish or something. Well, this is the largest group in the plethodontids. This is a plethodontid salamanders. Aeneades enus, or the green salamander. These are very arboreal. You'll find these in trees and under rock ledges, especially limestone rock ledges. And they have these little toe pads on there. But the coloration, you can't mistake them from anything else. They're a green flecks on black. Very pretty. The Teleco salamander was split out of the slimy salamander group, which is what used to be called Plethodon glutinosus. Now there's like 14 species in that group. And they all have this skin secretion. It's gluten, like glue. And when you pick one up, the stuff has to wear off your hands. You can use some really high-powered soap and scrub and scrub and scrub and sort of get it off, but it has to wear off. Predators, especially garter snakes, doesn't like to eat them. The redback, this is Plethodon cinereus. Petranka says that this particular salamander, by biomass, exceeds any other vertebrate in the southern Appalachians. By biomass, it is the most abundant than any other vertebrate. That includes black bear, white-tailed deer, rabbit, turkey, skunks, squirrels. By biomass than any other species. Again, the slimy salamander group, they all look like that, but depending on where you are, where in the distributional range you're in, it could be a separate species. Zigzags is Plethodon dorsalis, and then the southern zigzag is ventralis, and then there's another one now that's called the valley. Valley zigzag, I think that they're calling it, and I forget the name. I was just reading that they split it out. Now, we found one over in Hancock County that I couldn't identify, and it was that new one. But they all kind of have these little zigzag patterns on their back. Jordan salamander, I told you earlier, I put this slide in here. This is the one that you find in the Unaka Mountain Range. This is the gray cheek, or the Appalachian gray-cheek salamander, Plethodon montanus. This is Plethodon jordani. There's also Plethodon metcalfi. This is another one of those slimies at Plethodon kentucki. You find that up around the state line. Southern ravine, this has an extremely long tail, an extremely slender salamander. When you first see them, you think there's a little snake there, but then you can discern the leg. But you find those really in deep ridge, deep valleys in the southern ridge in Tennessee. Southern redback is serratus. That's the one I was trying to think of, I think. And that's the red-legged. I've never seen one of these, and people say they're here. I've never seen one. I've looked a lot, but I've never seen one. Plethodon shermani. It's supposed to be in Tennessee, I guess. I don't know anybody's ever found one in Tennessee. They just suspect that they're here and put them on the range map. Whoop. Plethodon tiali, again, is one of those slimy salamanders from down in Monroe County. Should put all those together to show you how many of those there are. These have very little sparse flecking on them, and then the flecking, instead of being white, is gold. I've seen these before. This is the rarest salamander in Tennessee, known from only two specimens. from Campbell County. And the frog is known from only two specimens is the gopher frog from Coffee County. Plethodon whirlii, up in the no business section of Royal Blue Wildlife Management Area. They're found in Kentucky and in Ohio and other places, but only in Tennessee, we only know of two specimens. Weller salamander probably has the most restricted range of any of our salamanders, and it's a very handsome animal. These pictures really don't do it justice. It's a kind of a beige color with silver flecking on it, and it's very bright. When you shine your light on it, it actually reflects the light back. And there's the range of the whole planet Earth. A little bit in North Carolina, a little bit in Virginia, and a little bit in Tennessee. The Yonelossi is a little bit more in Tennessee, a little bit more in Virginia, a little bit more in North Carolina. But the Weller has a very, very restricted range. There's the Yonelossi, my favorite. You've seen about 9 slides of this. And this was taken by my favorite professor, Dr. Jerry Nagel from East Tennessee State. And this is oxalis, this plant, sour grass. And this was a big female that we found under a rotting log, and she was guarding her eggs. Very beautiful animal. Again, I like them. Yonelossi, that's Bob English's photographs here, and this is Nagel's. I just put that one in there. Look at it again. The mud puppies. Proteidae, water dogs, mud puppies as they're known, have external gills as adults. Find those in slow-moving rivers and lakes, reservoirs. They have persisted into reservoirs. A lot of our fisheries people find them when they're doing their traps in the lake. And then Salamandridae, that's the newts. The red-spotted newt has a reverse life cycle. As adults, they live in water. They have lungs, they breathe air, but they live in water as adults. And as young, they crawl around on land. Weird. And the skin is very dry, like sandpaper. And the tail is almost like a possum tail as far as the roundness of it. But then when they go back to water, their skin becomes moister. It's still kind of rough, but they have a keel tail and it's flattened and it's for swimming. Whereas on land, it's kind of like they drag it around with them. So that's the eastern newt. And this is the eye of the newt. Shakespeare. Sirens. Again, I showed you the siren from up in Cove Lake. They have very distinct front feet, external gills. And they live in kind of brackish water. Not the literal sense of brackish, but it doesn't have to be high water quality for them to live there. That's all I've got for salamanders. Anybody have any questions? Did I answer all the questions on your pretest? I didn't give you the author of the book. You'll have to figure that out yourself.
Is that the labeling?
What? 20. 30. Yeah, year-round. Season year-round. I don't see many frog hunters in January, though. But I guess as the climate gets warmer, we probably will. Bullfrogs are probably the number one hated amphibian west of the Mississippi River because they're exotic and they eat the native frogs. When you put them into other populations, they'll decimate native frog populations. Probably was one of the main reasons the Wyoming toad is so low in numbers.
You said the southern leopards are calling now, they're shocked too.
Something about the frogs are coming?
Are they calling?
Calling.
Oh, calling. Oh, I've heard them.
Yeah.
I never heard one before. I was walking up a hill of turkey the other morning before daylight and I heard one calling.
Yeah.
And the pickerel frog were calling. They've been calling a while. I've even heard fowler's toads call. Already. Usually when the temperature is 70 degrees at night, fowler's toads will start. And this warm spring we've had this year, you get both American toads and fowler's toads calling, they'll hybridize. And next year, you have this weird thing out there calling it the cross. Doesn't know what to do. Well, we don't have time for the frog thing, so got any questions? And then here's this poster I brought for you to look at. So if you'd like to come look at it, ask any questions, now's the time.
I think it's so nice what you said about the American Impalers hybridizing. There's something special about this year that makes them hybridize?
Yeah, usually they're partitioned by the temperature at night. The American toads usually breed much earlier in the season when the temperature is much cooler at night. But now, because this is such an early summer in the spring here, the temperature is 70 degrees and the Fowler's toads are starting to call. And so now they'll hybridize with the American toads. That happens ever so often, and it's happening more and more here recently.
Because it went from chilly to hot real quick.
That's right.
Introduction, especially to the salamander ID, to kind of get you all primed for our field trip up to the Smokies. And so hopefully we'll come across some of those species when we're up there.
Yeah, there's a lot of diversity there. Yonelosia salamander is not found in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And the Weller salamander range that I showed you, is that found down there?
No.
Nope. So neither of those are found in the Smokies. But yet the Smokies boast the highest diversity in eastern North America.
Not true.
It's the northern mountains are more diversity than they are. Ravines not found down there. A bunch of them are not there. So, but you still have a lot to look at.
Any other questions, y'all? Let's give Peter a round of applause.
Oh, you're welcome.